Hello, lunch breakers, my silly sunflowers. We've got a gem of a career confessions interview today. Before we jump into that, I wanted to share a little funny anecdote from the week. As I shared in last week's episode in my life update, I am on the job search and I'm looking for a great new learning and development, talent development role in a corporate space. And I'm in some interview processes for opportunities that seem like really good fits. And I actually had an interview today with someone who could possibly be on the team that I work on and was kind of taken aback when the first thing she said when we connected on Zoom was, "Oh, I was just listening to your podcast. It feels like we've been hanging out all day." I think my eyes kind of popped out of my head when she said that. And I shouldn't be surprised because the nature of building this personal brand and business is that everything about what I've been doing is online. It's highly visible and featured on my LinkedIn. And the point of building this personal brand is for folks to land on my LinkedIn, see it kind of as like a landing page for what I've been up to, and to find their way to the podcast or to the newsletter or to other ways that I help folks and share content. So in one way, it was a really great example or a reminder that like, oh, okay, the content pipeline is working. Folks are landing where I want them to land. But it was also a kind of an abrupt reminder of like, oh, I am being perceived. And I felt kind of vulnerable in that moment. But I share this with you because I have been public about my career development, my personal brand, and diversifying my career for more than 2 years now, almost 2.5 years. And even now, as many reps as I've put into building this thing and flexing the visibility muscle, sometimes it still does take me off guard a little bit. And that cannot be and should not be the reason that you don't get started. Because that is just a fact. If you choose to diversify your career in a way that is more public, that is putting yourself out there, and that's not the only way you can, but if that's what you choose, you will be perceived. And that is just the nature of the game. And the more reps you put into it, the more comfortable you will be, but it never feels completely natural. And that shouldn't be the thing that stands in your way. Because even someone with years of reps putting into this still gets a little bit caught off guard. And that's okay. It's all worth it if you're doing something that matters and that you're proud of. Anyway, I'm going to rein myself back in because today we have a gem of a career confessions interview with Emma Hinchliffe. And let me just say, Emma Hinchliffe knows what it takes to be influential. Emma writes Fortune Magazine's daily newsletter on the most powerful women and co-chairs the Most Powerful Women Summit. No big deal. So today, Emma, a career journalist and editor, shares her career confessions from starting at her college newspaper, raising her hand for stretch opportunities across the U.S., and ultimately landing a highly visible role where she is now, where she walks in lockstep with Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and gets on Zoom with the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. Super casual. Emma shares her tips for success that she's picked up from the world's most powerful women, all of the advice and gems that she's gathered from interviewing them face to face. She talks about how she tackles spicy conversations about the workplace, because we're all finding ourselves in those situations more and more these days, and what she sees as next for women in business. Let's dig right into Emma Hinchliffe's career confessions. This is Modern Mavericks, a podcast and newsletter for those of us who want more than just a job. I'm your host and career coach, Janelle Ibrahami. Whether you're a corporate go-getter, an entrepreneurial spirit, or a powerful blend of both, you're in the right place. I'm sharing actionable advice on how to take your career power back and build something you're proud of. Together, we'll help you create a career that's meaningful and meant for you. Because you're a maverick. Let's get started. Emma Hinchliffe, thanks for sitting down with me today. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. We are sitting down on a very warm day, at least in New York, and we've got some iced teas next to us. What do you usually have for your lunch break, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh my gosh, probably a Diet Coke. A little bit of one to get some caffeine, but not have any more coffee. And yeah, the lunch itself is kind of very. Sometimes it doesn't exist, but
No. The Diet Coke is a staple.
Diet Coke is a staple, yeah. Yes.
Love it. Well, for those of us listening, can you give us your professional power statement? So who you are and what you do.
Yeah. So my name is Emma Hinchliffe and I'm a journalist. I feel like a power statement, like journalists are such a unique type of person that it doesn't like come supernaturally to like describe yourself with like the perfect power statement. Basically, I'm just a journalist and I'm always looking for interesting, informative, and compelling stories to tell.
Love that. Yeah, I think that's so relatable that sometimes calling it a power statement maybe puts it into too narrow of a box that doesn't give space for all the different diverse ways that you can do what you do. So love that. So for some context, you and I actually go pretty far back. We met in high school when we were working on the high school paper together. And then you went on in college to become the editor-in-chief of the Georgetown student paper. Before we sat down to record, you're like, I actually don't remember working on the high school paper at all. So can you clue us into what was the spark moment for your journalism career?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say it was the high school paper, but really that was not a very strong commitment by me. But actually, my dad was a journalist. So when I was growing up, it was always kind of on my radar. He did radio, so it was very different, but always kind of knew about journalism as a career option, as opposed to, I think for some people who go into journalism, it's something you kind of have to discover more on your own when you're a little older. And it was kind of like the opposite, where I was always knew I was interested, but was sort of waiting for something else to grab my interest because I didn't want to just like follow in his footsteps. But then nothing else really ever did. I was just like, oh, I probably should just do journalism. So ended up trying the high school paper, got really involved in the college paper when I went to Georgetown and was editor-in-chief of the Hoya and really just kind of went from there.
That's amazing. Were you involved with the Hoya from like first day of freshman year?
Yeah, it was pretty much the only thing that I knew I wanted to do in college and at Georgetown. So it was definitely my main commitment and probably spent more hours there than I did, on my classes.
Yeah. So why did you say that you were always waiting for something else to show up for you or to reveal itself as maybe an alternative path or passion? And what made you eventually say, no, this is it. Journalism's the thing.
So I feel like, if you hear about journalism, you always hear like complaints about it. Like you hear that the pay is bad and it's hard to get into and it's not sustainable. So I feel like because of all those factors, I was always just sort of hoping maybe that I'd like something else, but that didn't really happen. And I think a lot of that is overblown. Like journalism is a really hard field, don't get me wrong, but there are plenty of opportunities and the field has evolved so much. Like you don't have to just move to a small paper in the middle of nowhere and jump from paper to paper until you end up at a major metro newspaper. Like there's so many different ways to write and report and be creative. So I'm glad that I eventually trusted my instinct.
That's so powerful. But speaking of like local newspapers, what did you do right after you graduated from Georgetown?
Yeah, right after I graduated, I ended up moving to Houston and worked for the Houston Chronicle, which is a major metro newspaper. Houston is the fourth biggest city in the country. So it was a great newspaper and definitely gave me a lot of experience working in a different market other than the East Coast, as well as like doing some of the basics, the foundational skills of reporting, like knocking on people's doors and reporting on crimes and kind of pounding the pavement, as they say. So it was a great experience.
When you say knocking on people's doors, what was that actually like?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's a very intimidating experience, but it's definitely helpful because now when I'm reporting on like business news, I'm not scared to call up anybody because when I was at the Houston Chronicle, I was going to a crime scene where someone had just like a murder suicide had just happened and like knocking on neighbors' doors to ask, did you know this person? What happened? Or even sometimes being required to knock on the door of a family that had just had something really horrific happen in their own family and having to ask questions about it. So it's not anyone's favorite thing to do, but yeah, it definitely makes you less scared to take on other challenges ahead.
Totally. I would expect that it just rips off the Band-Aid and forces you into that like audacity or gumption that you kind of have to knock on someone's door or ask some pretty tough questions. And as we'll get into later in the conversation, now you do that with really, really powerful people. You are walking side by side and across the table from some of the biggest names in business or even in the world. And I can understand or even see how that early experience of just being like, well, I've got to do it. I've got to talk to this person. Let me just muster up the courage to do it has lent itself to what you do now.
Yeah, totally.
So you've actually written on a couple of different beats throughout your career, like business, tech, money, and to city metropolitan news. How did you start to carve out your niche as a journalist?
Yeah, so I ended up in business news kind of by accident. In college, I had done a summer program for USA Today. And because I went to Georgetown, USA Today is based in DC. So when I went back to school that fall, I was like, hey, are there any internships available? And the only one left was on the money desk, which is their version of the business desk. So I ended up working on the money desk at USA Today. And then, you know, business journalism is a skill and it's something that it's more in demand oftentimes, especially at certain publications than, you know, just general interest news. And so as I progressed in my career, when I went to the Houston Chronicle, they knew that I had that business experience on my resume. So they sent me over to the business desk for a couple months. And then I was looking for jobs and really wanted to move back to New York and ended up going over to Mashable as a business reporter covering technology and just kind of went from there.
So would you say that sitting here today as a business journalist, it was a matter of choice, a matter of circumstance, or a little bit of both?
I think at first it was definitely a matter of circumstance. If you had asked me when I was 20 and in college, and already doing some journalism, if I wanted to cover business news, I would have said like, no way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Georgetown had a business school where people were like taking classes on Excel and like all these other skills and accounting. And I would have said like, keep me as far away from that as you possibly can. But it's definitely been a choice to stay in it. And I think there are so many fascinating stories in business. I mean, as you know, interviewing so many interesting folks in this space for the podcast and all the other things you do, there's so many interesting profiles to write about leaders and interesting stories about what's happening inside these large organizations that control so much of what happens in the world. So it's definitely been a choice to stick around.
I think you're so right in that space of business and reporting on business, I think has kind of exploded since you and I were in high school back in like the early aughts up to like 2010, 2011. And that at least my perspective of like what one would write about business was, you know, the NASDAQ or the stock exchange or this company is doing XYZ. But now business includes entrepreneurship, includes side hustles, includes like all of these brand building activities and collaborations that business in and of itself could have like five different sub niches within it.
No, totally. And I think like any skepticism that remains around like how interesting business journalism is or not is definitely just like a marketing problem. Mm. Like people, business journalists not successfully communicating the breadth of what that includes.
For sure. So in your current role at Fortune, you write the broadsheet and you co-chair the Most Powerful Women Summit for Fortune. How did you land that role?
Yeah, so that is definitely my sub-niche within business journalism is for a while now I've covered gender issues as well as women-led companies and female-founded companies. And that was the job that I applied for at Fortune at Mashable. I had covered women in tech as one of my beats for Mashable, so very focused on technology and often about workforce versus leaders, but still was engaged in that space. And so Fortune has had the Most Powerful Women franchise for 25 years. It's run the Most Powerful Women list, which ranks the 50 most powerful women in business in a very scientific way. And it's had the Most Powerful Women Summit, which is a conference series that brings together, you know, the leading women across corporate America and beyond. And so when I saw that job posting, I just applied. And since then have really been able to carve out such a great niche within business journalism.
That's incredible. So you kind of just found it, you applied, interviewed and got the job. And it's been about 5 years now that you've been with Fortune and Most Powerful Women and the broadsheet. Can you describe kind of like your ascent within Fortune and Most Powerful Women?
Yeah, totally. So I joined as an associate editor at Fortune and I was a couple years into my career and worked with some amazing, amazing business journalists who taught me so much and learned, you know, so much about what makes a good story in business journalism, what doesn't make a good story, just the basics of, you know, how to read company earnings reports and find stories within public documents and all of that. And as things have shifted at Fortune over the years, I've been able to take on more responsibility and just continue to dive deeper into the work that I started doing with the guidance of so many great journalists who came before me.
So did you raise your hand for a lot of these opportunities? Because I imagine if someone looks at your LinkedIn or they even look at your Instagram, honestly, you're on stage moderating these conversations with the most powerful women in business. How did you kind of get into those chairs? How did you find yourself literally in those positions?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, made it known that that was something I was interested in doing more of. But I was also really lucky to have a lot of folks who were more senior than me who really gave me a lot of opportunity and really supported me as I was first getting my feet in the door to be able to take on those kinds of things.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about how you made it known that you were interested in that and how you advocated for what you really wanted in your career?
Yeah. You know, I think I've always just been lucky to work with editors who, you know, really kind of have collaborated with you. And so you're able to say, like, I think this is a story. And even if they don't agree right away, just kind of talk through like why you're convinced that it's something that's worth your time. And so I was always able to say, you know, I was always very eager to take on tasks that would be helpful for the larger organization. But at this, and I think that that helped to be able to kind of do both, to be able to say, like, I'll, you know, pitch in wherever possible to help the publication, but also like, when there's one thing that comes up and it's like, this is an interview that I would really love to do, if that ends up making sense, there was a lot of goodwill to be able to help me do that.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So it kind of sounds like you made it known that you were always willing to roll up your sleeves so that by the time when you raised your hand, it was recognized and that goodwill was there, that kind of like capital that you had built, you were able to cash that in for the opportunities that you could see making sense for you or even just like stroking a passion of yours.
Yeah, I think so.
Awesome. So you have interviewed countless of game-changing women, from founders of the biggest brands and CEOs of newsmaking companies. It's truly wild if anyone gets the Broadsheet newsletter daily, which you should, just to see the name that Emma has interviewed for that issue. Having interviewed such a large sample size, what would you say are the common denominators of these women's successful careers?
I think there's a couple different things. I mean, when you're interviewing someone who's the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, that person is probably a little different than someone who's the founder of a very successful startup. Those are just very different mindsets. And the kind of personality traits that lead someone to pursue either path or the skill sets that lead them to succeed in either path are very different. So I would say someone who's the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, you know, is probably what you would think of, like extremely strict schedule, extremely just motivated, and, you know, oftentimes just a person who really has had their eye on the ball, who has done the work, who has risen the ranks in kind of that traditional way. And versus a founder of a hugely successful startup, also obviously extremely motivated, but also someone who's probably, you know, a bit more of a risk taker, someone who has really kind of had a vision and really pursued that and maybe hired people around them to who have the skill set that the Fortune 500 CEO might. And so definitely different categories of person with different ways to succeed, but there are definitely common threads between the two.
And so are there any habits or hacks that you've learned from the most powerful women that you've interviewed that you've implemented into your own life or career? Have you taken any of their nuggets and thought, that's a good one, I've got to run with that?
Oh my gosh, I'm trying to think. I mean, I think I've certainly tried to take a cue from their confidence and the way that they present themselves to the world. I mean, I think, you know, understanding the value that you bring and trusting that you're a person that people want to hear from and want to spend time with, that's a skill in and of itself. And I think spending time around people who have no question of that certainly helps to kind of internalize that in your own life.
Yeah, seeing that confidence modeled and demonstrated every time you sit down with someone. But I guess on the other hand, are there any moments that stick out to you when one of these most powerful women were not what you expected? And you don't have to use names, but any situations when perhaps the idea that we have of the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or the leader of an amazing innovative startup kind of didn't match what you expected?
Yeah, I think when you're meeting someone in an interview setting and interview setting as a journalist, not just like, you know, like a podcast setting, like really you're writing for a traditional publication, I think it's always going to be, you know, like you can admire someone, but at the end of the day, you're there to do an interview that hopefully, you know, reveals things that they might not want to volunteer immediately, that gets to the truth of whatever's going on, that addresses the hard questions. And so oftentimes, you know, that person is not going to be your best friend or the person who you come away from that conversation saying, you know, that person is the person I admire more than anyone else in the world, and they're my new like guiding light. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what kind of has helps to kind of keep you grounded a little bit, is really approaching these conversations not as like, I get to meet these cool people, but as, you know, I'm a journalist, I know what my role is, and there's a reason I'm talking to all of these folks.
For sure. So that's actually a really great point. When you are walking in lockstep, you know, with politicians and CEOs sitting across the table from them in this kind of moment that matters, how do you personally prepare to get the most out of that moment that matters?
Yeah, I mean, I think preparation in general, you know, you can't overstate how helpful it is if you, you know, really prepare to ask the right questions, but also leave room open for follow-ups and, you know, just have your brain really turned on so you really take advantage of opportunities to pivot and dive deeper when it's needed. I think you can't overstate the importance of preparation, of just knowing your subject before you go in, preparing and reading and watching past interviews that they've done to see what they're asked all the time. And maybe you'll have to ask those same questions that they're asked all the time because there's a reason that they're asked them, but also trying to bring a new spin to things and surface a conversation that isn't just the same old, same old. But at the same time, I mean, another way to prepare is just to think about why you're there. Like, for instance, if I was meeting, you know, I think Jacinda Ardern or Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, just as me in like a room at a dinner party, I'd probably be extremely, extremely nervous and have no idea what to say. But if I'm going into these conversations as Emma from Fortune and as a journalist, you know, there's a reason that I'm there. And it's a much different kind of mental calculation entering those conversations.
Totally. So do you have any kind of work rituals that you do to prepare for any of these conversations, or even rituals that help you do your best work when you're not interviewing anyone?
Yeah, I try to just kind of trust my gut. Like, for instance, I know, you know, I think there's so much conversation around like morning routines and getting yourself in the best headspace. And like, I'm not a morning person. I'm never going to have like a huge morning routine that keeps me grounded and that I do every single day. So just like understanding that maybe I'll do my best work at 2 p.m. and maybe I'll do some of my best work at 11 p.m. and really just trusting that I can bring that value at any time really helps me to be the most productive and do the best work.
Yeah. So it kind of sounds like giving yourself the space and grace to know, like, this doesn't have to look like a very strict template that I follow every day, but I trust when my energy is going to come up and present itself and I'll make the most of it when it does.
Yeah, exactly.
We love that. I think we need more conversation in the like productivity space for just space and grace. Like, I am totally with you that I have tried so many times over so many years to, there's like a graveyard of journals that I tried to do, or like 5-minute journals that I've tried to use early in the morning. But really, I get my best journaling done right before I go to bed and I have something to reflect on from the day. And I don't need like a 15-step morning routine. I just need to do 3 things and then I'm out the door and I'll figure out what comes for the rest of the day. So that's just a plug for a little more expanded conversation around the productivity and like routine chatter.
Oh my gosh, I'm totally with you. Thank you for being an advocate for those of us who are not morning people.
You are seen. I would also love to know how you've collected mentors along the way in your career. You talked about raising your hand and collaborating with bosses that you really admire, or learning from other journalists in your space. What has mentorship looked like throughout the years of your career?
Yeah, mentorship has been so critical, especially in the 5 years that I've been at Fortune. I wouldn't say that I really had like one person who I would consider a mentor before that. But when I got to Fortune, there were so many amazing journalists and amazing women who were probably all like between 9 to 20 years older than me and had been working for obviously that much longer and were so good at what they did, so welcoming, and really, really helped me to get better as a writer, as a reporter, and as an interviewer when it comes to onstage interviews. And so being able to learn from the best in the business, including folks who were my direct bosses and people who weren't, really being able to have that mix was so, so critical.
Folks who were your direct bosses and ones who weren't. How do you personally think about mentorship? Are you someone who prefers to have that like one guru on the mountaintop that you can go to time and time again? Or do you prefer more kind of like mentor moments with a lot of different people across a scatter plot of mentorship possibility?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great to have one person, but oftentimes that's not going to be realistic. Like, it would be great if one person could meet all your needs, but that's probably not going to happen forever. And if it does, it might change at some point. And so I think having different people who you can go to for different things has been really, really important.
Yeah. Have you been able to be a mentor to other folks as you've climbed up in your journalism career?
Yeah, hopefully. I have definitely tried to do that and definitely would love to bring more folks into covering business and the gender and social equity space within business.
Yeah.
I think like when people hear about covering women in business or covering gender and racial equity issues within business, I think there's oftentimes an assumption of what that means. It means that, you know, you are a cheerleader for the people you're covering and that you're supporting them and that that's why you're in this space. And obviously, I think you wouldn't be covering these issues if you didn't care about them. But also, you know, I'm still a journalist and anyone who's on this beat at a journalism organization is still a journalist. And so you're covering these issues because you care, but you're not just cheerleading for the people who you're writing about. And so I think it's important to really kind of separate that and understand the role of a journalist versus an advocacy organization. You know, we're there to shine a light on stories that are not told when that's the appropriate thing to do. But if there's someone who we've covered who's also made a mistake, we're also there to cover that. And we're also there to cover like the systemic issues. And, you know, I think to try to like get attention to these stories in new ways, because I think another problem that comes up is that there can be like a sense of fatigue around these stories. Like Everyone who works in startups and venture capital has heard the statistic that women founders only get 2% of venture capital funding over and over. And that's a stat that hasn't really moved for several years. It goes from 1.9 to 2.2, but it just really doesn't budge. And that's also for companies that are founded only by women. So it doesn't include companies that have founders of multiple genders. But it's a stat that hasn't budged. And I think trying to figure out how to bring attention to that in new ways and to not let people forget that that's still a problem, but also telling the story in a way that it hasn't been told every single year that the data has been summed up for the past 10 years, like that's a challenge. So I think it's just a mix of defining journalism as differently than, you know, just someone who cares about these issues and is not a journalist, and also just trying to keep these stories top of mind, but also keeping them fresh.
Yeah, keeping them fresh. I think actually we have a really cool opportunity to talk about, since you have such a body of work behind you covering women in tech and women in business, so many folks who listen to this podcast who are listening right now aspire to be top women in business, to found something, to start their own thing. Looking back on your body of work, are there any kind of gems or main takeaways that you would want to impress upon someone listening right now who aspires to be maybe a woman covered in the broadsheet one day?
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously it depends where that person is in their career. But I mean, for someone who's kind of pursuing a path as an entrepreneur or imagines that that's something they might want to do, I think, you know, staying convicted, staying, you know, true to your convictions and telling the story that is unique to you, I think is the best way to really break through. I think people talk about authenticity all the time, but like, it's really so important. Like, that's the main thing that gets me to cover like an earlier stage startup that we're not covering simply for news value, is if it has like a real story and a story that resonates with who the founder is and where they're coming from and really just is true to who that person is and the mission and why they're building something. And So I would say, just for someone who's looking for that coverage in the future, of course, there's lots of conversations about like the mechanics of how to secure press coverage. But beyond that, I think just, you know, authenticity is really the key.
Authenticity, telling a true story, telling a story that actually matters to you, and then trusting that it'll find its audience.
Yeah. And understanding that, you know, understanding the place of your story, that, you know, a journalist is covering your story for their readers. They're not covering it to promote your business, and they're not covering it for the same reasons that you want to get coverage. So understanding what the difference is and where that like true value lies for the greater world and society.
Right. Because your newsletter and fortune is not PR. It's journalism. It's news. And those are two very different things as a business owner, as a creator, as whatever it is. Emma, because you're in such a visible role, literally landing in thousands and thousands of inboxes every day in front of key players and on stages, what kind of mindset blocks have you had to overcome throughout your career or maybe even recently?
That's one thing that's different about writing a newsletter versus when you are writing other kinds of stories, is you know exactly how many people it's going to every single day. And you know who some of those people are. And some of them might be people that are, you know, extremely successful and well-known, and people that you might be nervous to be reading your work every day. And I think just the key to doing a good job is just kind of putting all of that aside. Like, when I'm writing the broadsheet every day, I'm not thinking about how many people are going to be reading it. Maybe I'm thinking about, oh, I think this might be really interesting for our audience, and this might be something that a larger share of our audience is interested in today, whether it's something that's really, you know, popping in the news cycle that day, or a writing about a person that they really care about. But, you know, just trying to put aside like the fears about who's reading this and how many people are reading this and just focus on the work is, I think, the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Focusing on the work. I think that's so applicable too, even in career circles today and folks diversifying their career and taking on side hustles. A lot of that has to do with content creation. And we hear a lot about what gets in the way of people actually putting their work out there is worrying about being cringy or worrying about what people will think when they receive it. But if you're proud of the work that you're putting out there, if it means something to you, if you're putting it out there with intention, you can't really think about how it's going to be perceived by Susie Q on the other side of her screen or her phone. You really just have to put something out there that you stand by and trust that with consistency and putting in the reps, it's going to find its audience and it's going to find that traction.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And there's so much overlap between, you know, my experience and the experience of someone doing the kind of work that you're describing. I think just focusing on the work and trusting your gut and doing something that you're convinced matters, like, really makes all the difference, whether it's because you're nervous about reaching a ton of people that you know are reading it, or whether it's because you're nervous about doing something that you worry is cringy.
We're all on Mount Cringe. I don't know if you've seen that, like, some piece of TikTok or some piece of content. It's like, the way to get to success is over Mount Cringe. Like, you need to cross and climb Mount Cringe to get to success. There's no way around it. So just embrace the cringe and know that that's going to happen. And then once you know that that's something that you can expect, great. It's not a surprise anymore. But like, embrace being a big cringy loser sometimes and know that like, you're going to find your audience.
Yeah, you gotta.
You gotta. All right, Emma Hinchliffe, we have a couple of standard lunch break questions that we love to ask every Career Confessions guest rapid fire. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Amazing. If you could hear anyone's career confessions at all, who would it be?
I could hear anyone's. At the moment, I'm very interested in Roz Brewer, who is the CEO of Walgreens. She is a really fascinating executive. She used to be the CEO of Sam's Club, and she was also the number two at Starbucks for a while. And she is just a really admired Fortune 500 executive. She's one of only two Black female CEOs currently in the Fortune 500. But she's also currently has been dealing with a major crisis because she's been leading Walgreens. And you might remember that Walgreens was having a lot of protest and criticism over a decision about whether or not they would dispense the abortion pill, mifepristone, with the ongoing lawsuit that is just now, while we're recording, progressing through the legal system. And so I think anyone like that, who's someone who personally you'd really admire, but as a business leader, you know, is maybe in a situation where they're faced with really tough choices and are making decisions that are not satisfying anybody, I think would love to hear about navigating that.
Yeah, navigating, making decisions that are not satisfying everybody, for sure. So what is in the Emma Hinchliffe Smarter Pack, aka what helps you work smarter and not harder?
I think the key thing that helps me do my best work and work smarter, not harder, is just having control over my own time. You know, I'm lucky to be in a position where I don't have that many internal meetings that I'm required to be at that I don't choose to be at. I'm often, you know, mostly setting my own schedule, whether it's scheduling interviews with folks who I'm speaking to for stories or taking networking meetings or whatever. So being able to say, like, on this day, I'm going to be running around the city and meeting with a bunch of people. On this day, I'm going to be hunkered down and like working from my bed while I try to write like a 2,000 word draft of a story. And on this day, I'm going to, you know, be in the office and chatting with folks who I actually work with at my actual company. I think that has been extremely key to working smarter, not harder.
Incredible. That honestly sounds like the dream of like total choice of like hybrid flexibility. Any tools or resources that would also be in your smarter pack?
Definitely my Diet Coke. That is really important.
Shout out. Let's not forget.
Yes. Sponsored by Diet Coke. That is really important when the afternoon slump rolls around. I also think, you know, the rain sounds that you can listen to on Spotify. I cannot write and listen to any form of music. It's just too distracting and I cannot concentrate. So my Spotify has a lot of, I don't really like the white noise. I do like the rain sounds. So rain sounds and Diet Coke are probably the two tools that support my stories.
I love that. It's so real. And your whole Spotify Wrapped is just rain sounds, 1 through 5.
They're definitely up there.
And finally, Emma, what words of wisdom would you have for someone who wants to create a more intentional career?
Yeah, I would say just really take the time to reflect on what you're doing and why. And I think it can be so hard when there are, you know, so many opportunities or so many demands on your time. But I think it's really hard to be intentional. I think you get everyone, myself included, gets so wrapped up in the day to day and the things to check off your to-do list and the calendar. But being able to take a step back and say, do I want to be doing this and why? And what do I want to be doing and why? I think is so critical. And so really just, you know, taking that big picture time to reflect is extremely important.
Yes. Big picture time to reflect. Speaking of the big picture, what is next for you?
Oh my gosh. Well, I am continuing to write stories for Fortune and do interviews at the Fortune events I co-chair. So we have the Most Powerful Women Next Gen Summit coming up. So looking forward to talking to some great folks there. I think we're slated to speak with Tracy Ellis Ross and the new CEO of Glossier. So some great folks who will be sharing their wisdom with us there, as well as always just looking for interesting stories to tell about executives who are doing something that is really impactful in some way, whether it's good or bad, on the world, and also bring to that a personal story that really has an impact on the work they're doing.
And how can we keep up with you?
Yes, please subscribe to the broadsheet available on fortune.com if you search for Fortune newsletters.
We'll link it in the show notes too, for sure.
Yes, it'll hit your inbox 5 days a week, mornings Eastern time. You can also find me on Instagram at Emma Hinchliffe, on Twitter at _ Emma Hinchliffe, and on LinkedIn.
Love it. Thank you so much for sitting down with us, Emma. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Janelle.